This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 145, From Antiochus to Ashoka. Last time, we covered a grab bag of historical events, including the foundation of many new cities and wannabe cities that never quite made it to proper urbanization. That also included building up a couple of temples in Babylonia, reorganizing the administrative structure of the empire, shifting the capital district to northern Syria, and continuing combat in Anatolia. It all culminated with the rebellion of Eumenes I of Pergamon, who turned his city into a small independent state near the Troad. This time, we are shifting gears to the other side of the empire to cover a long span of time that we just don't have a lot of information on. The last time we checked in with the Indian subcontinent, Chandragupta Maurya had just beaten Seleucus Nicator and traded a few hundred elephants for the entire Indus Valley, the Hindu Kush, and the easternmost provinces of the Iranian plateau. Chandragupta went on to conquer vast swaths of central India, carefully focusing on the urbanized river valleys and rival kingdoms, while leaving the more tribal peoples of the mountains and forests for his descendants to deal with. In between conquests, Chandragupta would return to his capital city on the eastern Ganges, Pataliputra, and help his prime minister Chanakya manage their growing imperial state. Part of running a vast and powerful empire was, of course, meeting with ambassadors from your neighbors to address issues like trade, border disputes, and so on. Most of the ambassadors visiting Pataliputra would have come from the increasingly tiny kingdoms and oligarchies around the northern and southern parts of the Indian subcontinent. However, at least one came from the west. An ambassador from the recently defeated Greeks ruled by King Seleucus. This episode is partly going to be a stealth meet the neighbors episode to get caught up on Indian history while we're here, largely because we don't have a ton of information about what these ambassadors were doing. All of them wrote about their time in India, but later generations were understandably more interested in their descriptions of far-off alien culture, rather than the minutiae of day-to-day diplomacy. However, I think it's worth noting that one of the reasons we don't hear much about the Eastern Seleucid Empire after the first war with Chandragupta is because these ambassadors were good at their jobs. There were no further wars between the Seleucids and the Maurya. Instead, the efforts of these envoys created a stable and prosperous economic and cultural exchange for both sides in the first few generations, after Seleucus and Chandragupta built their kingdoms. The first Seleucid ambassador to their eastern neighbor was Megasthenes. We know relatively little about Megasthenes as a person. Presumably, just given his generation, he was one of the many Greeks to emigrate into Seleucid territory. In all likelihood, he was a veteran of either Alexander's Wars or the early wars of the Diadochoi in some capacity. Regardless, Megasthenes would have arrived in the East at the latest during Antigonus Monophthalmos' tenure as ruler of the Upper Satrapies, starting his career in the region under Sibirtius, a high-ranking officer of little note under Alexander, who wound up as satrap of Arachosia following the partition of Babylon. It is a shame that we don't know more about how and when Megasthenes got to Arachosia, because it would explain a lot about his relationship to Seleucus. Sibirtius had generally opposed Seleucus during the latter's first term as satrap of Babylon, but he submitted to Seleucid rule after the Babylonian War against Antigonus. Then, when Chandragupta annexed Arachosia, Sibirtius apparently came as part of the package deal, retaining his position as governor under Mauryan rule in an odd system of an Indian conqueror delegating authority to a Greek conqueror in a province defined by the Persians and inhabited by only a small handful of any of those groups alongside the native people. Arrian claims that Megasthenes traveled with the army of Alexander the Great, which is certainly possible. But Arrian is also the only ancient author we know of who actually liked Megasthenes' writing. So he may have been trying to make the diplomat sound more credible as an ethnographer. Modern historians debate whether or not he was really a Seleucid diplomat, with some arguing that he could have gone to India on Antigonus's orders instead. There is a certain amount of logic to that, given his home base with Sibirtius. However, that idea runs into conflict with the most likely dates for Chandragupta's conquest. As usual, I think it is best to assume that the ancient authors who cited Megasthenes as a source probably knew more than we do, and can be taken at their word that Megasthenes claimed to have been Seleucus's ambassador. Megasthenes was probably charged with negotiating the finer details of the Seleucid Mauria Treaty and establishing where exactly the borders would be defined. These were both brand new states, constantly at war with their neighbors. So we can assume that there were discussions about tax policies, hiring mercenaries from one another, shipping rights, extradition, and so on. We don't know any of the details, of course, but that can all be inferred from the basic details of the situation. Megasthenes' big contribution to the historical record was actually being the very first European to travel to and write about the regions of central and eastern India. To do his job, Megasthenes had to cross the Punjab and travel up the Ganges to meet with Chandragupta and his ministers in Pataliputra, giving him never-before-recorded perspective on India as a whole. So naturally, much like Theseus and Nearchus before him, more reputable Western historians in the centuries after Megasthenes ridiculed his account of the East as unbelievable and full of lies. Also, much like those earlier examples, it's incredibly hard for modern historians to parse fact from fiction, from borrowed facts and fictions, from poorly described facts and fictions. Megasthenes saw more of India than any Western author before him, but he still only saw a very small sliver of Indian geography and culture. essentially just what he could observe along the major rivers and roadways between Arachosia and Pataliputra, as well as life at the Mauryan court. He clearly supplemented his personal experiences with stories told by Indians he met and other familiar sources. For example, he repeated Herodotus's famous description of gold-digging ants and Theseus's tales of unicorns. That said, I've discussed before how both examples have pretty reasonable explanations when you look at them as poorly understood descriptions of real phenomena. Herodotus's ants were potentially mistranslated descriptions of marmots burrowing in gold-rich soil. Theseus's unicorns were almost certainly a poorly described rhinoceros. In fact, Megasthenes says that Theseus got his description wrong and described something even more rhino-sounding. Megasthenes also brought new descriptions into the fore, describing monkeys larger than the biggest dog. There's no primate besides humans quite that big in India, but the rest of his description is pretty consistent with the iconic Indian logger monkey, which is pretty big as monkeys go, just not bigger than a large dog. He also describes enormous flying scorpions that sting indiscriminately, and winged serpents that release urine that can cause putrid sores. At a glance, these flying monsters sound ridiculous or terrifying. Under further inspection, there's a pretty good chance that he is talking about giant wasps and cobras. Wasps, including the Asian giant wasp, get a lot bigger and more dangerous in tropical regions like India than Europeans would be familiar with. They also can have more distinctly segmented bodies and atypical coloration that might lend itself to being described as a flying scorpion. A snake that secretes venomous fluid, hunts at night, and spreads wings is a ringer for the iconic Indian cobra. It just doesn't actually fly. And both of these explanations make a lot more sense if you remember that they were being described through a language barrier. Other animals, dismissed as fantasy by early critics, are even more obvious. Like a snake so large it can swallow large animals whole. That's a boa constrictor. Or a small fish off the Indian coast that is rarely seen alive but floats to the surface and stuns anyone who touches its body. That's an electric eel. Then there are more familiar and accurately described animals. Megasthenes wrote extensively on how Indians raised and bred elephants in captivity, something the Hellenistic kingdoms would always struggle to do themselves. That's not to say that everything is secretly flawless. He still wrote about tribes of people with no mouths, no heads, or the heads of dogs. He also seemed to struggle with the diversity of religious philosophy in Mauryan territory. Megasthenes provided the first detailed descriptions of Indian religious and philosophical beliefs to the West, but they are a hodgepodge of Vedic, Buddhist, Jain, and other beliefs all rolled together and presented as if they were universal. That said, together with his attempts to reconcile Indian myths and legends with the Greeks' own mythology, these early descriptions of Indian beliefs would go on to form some of Megasthenes' lasting legacy. Between directly writing about Indian philosophy for a Western audience, and negotiating the basic terms of Seleucid-Maurya relations, our first ambassador set the stage for several centuries of religious and philosophical cross-pollination on either side of the Hindu Kush. That said, things like Buddhist influence on Neoplatonist philosophy and the Dionysian mysteries will have to wait for another day. Today, we are playing catch-up, which means we need to move past Chandragupta's time and on to his successor, Bindusara Amitragata. Bindisara the Slayer of Enemies. Chandragupta probably died in the mid-290s BC, passing the throne to a man who was probably his son, possibly adopted or stepson. At least one poem identifies Bindusara as the son of the Nanda kings, so it's possible that Chandragupta adopted him or married his mother after conquering Magadha. It's also possible, very likely even, that Bindusara was the biological son of Chandragupta and a Nanda princess. The 12th century CE Jain legend, Parish Ishta Paravan, at least claims that he did marry a Nanda princess. Megasthenes probably wasn't living at the Maurya court anymore when Bindusara came to power. And given that the ambassador was probably the same age as the old king or older, he too likely died in the mid-290s. To the best of our knowledge, there was no formal Seleucid embassy to India for at least a decade. That said, the Seleucid princess sent to marry Chandragupta, and any half-Seleucid royalty produced from that union, would still have been around as an informal presence in Bindusara's court. That is, after all, the whole point of a marriage alliance like that. You get to have relatives in foreign affairs for at least a generation. Like his predecessor, Bindusara's history is known primarily through religious texts, epic poems, and historical fiction, all written many centuries later, but his time in power followed general trends that are pretty typical for this sort of second generation in a rapidly built empire. The major military theater of Bindusara's reign was in Deccan, a large plateau that makes up most of inland southern India. Modern historians debate whether or not this was a fresh conquest, suppression of a revolt, or somewhere in between. For what it's worth, coming from someone who has not read nearly enough about this time and place, something in between would make sense to me. Maybe a bit like the difference between the Persian conquest of Egypt under Cambyses and Darius the Great defeating the Behistun rebels in Egypt, immediately after the conquest. A region is conquered, the conquering king dies, and the region declares independence. When the new king arrives and defeats them again, is that suppressing a revolt or just finishing a conquest started by his predecessor? That's more a question of perspective than anything else. Regardless, Deccan marks the real transition point. Once Chanakya was more or less out of the picture, Bindusara had to make his empire his own. Militarily, this meant continuing attempts at expansion, but much like the Persian Empire 250 years earlier, all of the big prizes had already been won, and their ability to continue expanding started to run into practical limits of manpower and logistics in the 3rd century. Tamil Sangam literature occasionally references a Mauryan conquest of Tamilakam, the southernmost region of mainland India. However, no source, neither Tamil nor northern nor foreign, actually describes this, and there isn't much physical or literary evidence to back it up. At the same time, the Tamil kingdoms of the south would have been the logical next step for Bindusara to expand the empire. They were the next urbanizing and wealthy region in the direction that he was already expanding. What we do know is that Bindusara's successors had good relations with their southern neighbors, and there are at least references to something happening. So one theory that makes a lot of sense, especially approaching this with comparisons to the Achaemenids in mind, is that the second generation king attacked his smaller, wealthy neighbors, but they put up more of a fight than conquest was really worth. Instead, the powerful empire settled for cultural and political hegemony through limited intervention and economic influence. In today's case, it's the Maurya exerting de facto control over most of Timilacom, but it's pretty easy to compare with the Achaemenids in Greece. One of the more surprising aspects of Bindusara's early reign is that Chanakya, the Maurya Empire's first prime minister, was still alive and advising the new king, even though he was at least 20 years older than Chandragupta. That said, Chandragupta Maurya appears to have been fairly young, likely in his 50s when he died. So Chanakya, living into his 70s with a much less militant lifestyle, isn't beyond the realm of possibility. What happened to Chanakya under Bindusara's reign is up for more debate. At least three accounts of the early Maurya period end with Chanakya retiring as an ascetic in the forest, content with a very successful life and quietly passing the torch to a new generation. That's possible. But those same sources are also the ones that are either more fictitious or moralizing. The Jain text Rajavalikatha even says that both Chanakya and Chandragupta quietly retired, which is very unlikely. A very, very late source, the Tibetan monk Taranatha, wrote a history of Buddhism in the 16th century CE, working from now lost or inaccessible sources that say Chanakya was given official control of Deccan after its conquest in a sort of retirement package. Those are the favorable versions of the story. The Parish Ishtaparvan tells a darker tale. Chanakya was trying to set Bindusara up for success by appointing his own successor as prime minister, a man named Subandhu. But Subandhu wanted to speed up his own rise to power and revealed a secret to the king. When Bindusara was born, Chanakya was the presiding physician at court and had to perform a C-section. That was entirely realistic in ancient medicine, but without modern blood clotting agents and surgical precision, all but guaranteed to be fatal for the mother. Bindusara was enraged, blaming Chanakya for his mother's death, and fired the old man, not understanding the reason behind the surgery. When someone finally explained that both the king and his mother would have died without intervention, it was too late, and Chanakya refused to come back to the royal service. Subandhu was tasked with convincing his predecessor to return, and just murdered Chanakya instead. It is not a particularly likely story, given that it relies on a several weeks gap between your mother died in a C-section and this is what a C-section is for. The Parish Ishtaparvan is also a Jain source, and Bindusara's reign saw the decline of Jain influence on the royal court in favor of stronger ties with Buddhism. So Jain chroniclers had every reason to paint him in a negative light. However, it does tie into one of the other themes of Bindusara's reign: increasingly corrupt ministers and subordinates. Chanakya and Chandragupta had built a gargantuan administrative state that allowed their new empire to expand rapidly and compete with the well-established powers of the West. However, that left a lot of opportunity for petty and corrupt governors and ministers to flourish. The most notable example came in Taxila, the great academic center and capital city of the Indus Valley. Later in Bindusara's reign, Taxila rebelled, and Bindusara dispatched his son Ashoka to besiege the city. Supposedly, he was sent there without an army until the gods themselves intervened. But I think we can probably ignore that detail for history's sake, both because metaphysical intervention isn't really something we can deal with, and because no matter how much he disliked his son, I don't think Bindusara would have sent Ashoka to retake a rebel city without soldiers. When Ashoka arrived in Takshila, the rebel leaders of the city explained the situation. It was not a war of secession. They had no problem with Bindusara, Ashoka, or Maurya rule in general. But the governors appointed to run the Indus Valley were corrupt despots that overtaxed their people. All Ashoka had to do was promise to replace the governors, and they were happy to let him into the city for more detailed negotiations. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. When Antiochus Soter became king of the Seleucid Empire, he was a bit too busy to establish formal relations with his eastern neighbor, as we have discussed in most of our recent episodes. The early 270s were just far too chaotic to worry about something like that. However, in the brief lull between the outburst of rebellion in 281 and the Galatian War, Antiochus did find time to engage with Indian relations. He sent Demachus of Plataea, a Greek emigrant who had likely fled to the Seleucid court during one of the Antigonid Wars in Europe. Like Megasthenes, Demachus wrote about his time in the East and published several books for Greek audiences, but they were not well received and have not survived. Most of the later references to his work cite him primarily for general details about India alongside other Indica authors and describe Demachus as particularly unreliable. Once again, some of this must be down to poorly worded secondhand descriptions, because Demachus does seem to have spent a fair amount of time in Mauryan territory. He couldn't have been wholly ignorant, as his critics suggest. Yet he too fell into the trap of playing up the fantastical elements of far-off places and uncritically reporting old myths. As a result, most of his works are lost. Again, this episode isn't about the details of cultural and philosophical exchange, But one of the great casualties of later generations' dislike for Democus is probably a work titled On Piety, apparently a Greek description of different Indian religious beliefs. And this was part of one of the more interesting developments in Mauryan relations with the West under Bindusara, a very intentional policy of cultural exchange. No two cultures can exist right next to one another without some sort of cultural influence spreading back and forth. But Bindusara seems to have made a real effort to do this on purpose. According to the 2nd century CE philosopher Athenaeus, Bindusara once requested an odd trio of imports from the court of Antiochus I. Date wine, figs, and a sophist, that is, a teacher of Greek rhetoric and philosophy. Antiochus responded by saying that he would send the wine and the figs right away, but by law he could not sell a sophist. Apparently, it never occurred to him to ask for volunteers rather than selling one of his professors into slavery, but I digress. The fact that Bindusara wanted a Greek educator in his court points to an intentional interest in foreign philosophy. And while Antiochus didn't provide that, other Westerners might have. Ptolemy Philadelphus, all the way in Egypt, sent his own ambassador to India. The Ptolemies were very far away by land, but remember from the first Syrian War episode, Philadelphus engaged in a very intentional effort, in a directed effort to colonize the coast of the Red Sea. He was trying hard to achieve a naval and merchant presence in the Indian Ocean, in large part so he could trade with Eastern Arabia and India directly. So Egypt sent a man named Dionysius, likely near the end of Bindusara's reign. Apparently, Dionysius also wrote an Indica, but we don't even get ancient book reviews for that one. Bindusara came to power before either of the Western monarchs he negotiated with, and he died before either of them as well, likely sometime in the 270s. He left an empire primed for civil war. Bindusara's favorite son and chosen successor was Tsushima, according to the Ashoka Vedana. Other accounts are more vague and don't explain the succession plan in detail, but they agree that it did not go as intended. Unfortunately for Tsushima, he was only his father's favorite candidate. Tsushima had just recently failed to suppress a second revolt in Takshila and returned home with the important city still up in arms. The ministers and nobility largely sided with his brother, Ashoka, a competent military leader and political strategist. Had Tsushima or one of his brothers had just a bit more standing with the nobility, it could have fractured the empire, but most of the government rallied behind Ashoka, discarding Bindusara's final wishes and installing their preferred candidate as king instead. Tsushima and many other princes were killed on the new monarch's orders. Ashoka the Great is much, much too important of a historical figure for me to just cram in at the end of an episode, and I fully intend to come back to him at some point. His reign overlaps with Antiochus I and the next two Seleucids, so we have time. However, his most important contribution to foreign relations, and one of the most important events in Indian historiography, is usually dated to the reign of Antiochus I, so I want to get him in here with just the most basic summary. Later legends present Ashoka's time as a prince as a time of divine omens and prophecies, building him up as a chosen monarch. But Bindusara had good reason for not wanting Ashoka to succeed him. Ashoka's father was willing to give him important positions as a governor, but only ever as a subordinate. Because the young Ashoka Moria, just about 30 years old at this point, was a monster. The Ashoka Vedana, the epic about Ashoka's life, and several other briefer sources besides describe his evil deeds. He would give his nobles and courtiers meaningless but impossible tasks to prove their loyalty, then execute them for failure. He was a big fan of rape, torture, and mass murder, at one point being accused of executing 500 of his own concubines. Most consistently across several sources, he constructed a fortress outside of Pataliputra. It was decorated as a palace with beautiful gardens, luxurious baths, and rich decorations, but its true purpose was a prison, overseen by a jailer named Girika, Ashoka's head executioner and master of torture. The place was called Ashoka's Naraka, Ashoka's Hell. These stories are almost certainly exaggerated. Some of them are probably entirely fictional, but they have some roots in the reality of Ashoka's Kalinga War, which overlapped with the later years of Antiochus I's reign. Kalinga was a forested kingdom on the Bay of Bengal, and the only major state in the north to have resisted Mauryan conquest. In Ashoka's own propaganda, he claims that 100,000 men and animals were killed in battle. That many more died outside of combat, either in massacre or from disease, and that 150,000 men and animals were captured and taken back to Pataliputra as slaves and loot. These claims may be exaggerated as well. They don't appear in the inscriptions aimed at the Kalinga people themselves, although that easily could be interpreted as not trying to rub salt in the open wound. The important part is that the Kalinga War went down in history for its incredible brutality. Brutality that Ashoka went on to regret. The process may have begun before the Kalinga War, but near its end, something happened. Every different source tells a different version, but Ashoka had a life-changing encounter with a Buddhist missionary. The Moria had always been vaguely supportive of Buddhism and formed close relationships with the movement, but up to this point, they had not formally given up the Vedic Brahmanic beliefs that formed a basis for their authority. Ashoka reckoned with his cruelty and came out of the Kalinga War with all the zeal of a fresh convert. He tore down Ashoka's hell, executed his own executioner, and expressly made his regrets known in official propaganda. He poured money into Buddhist stupas and temples, organized the Third Buddhist Council to solidify Buddhist orthodoxy, and formed very close relations with the Buddhist Kingdom of Sri Lanka. To be perfectly clear, he still had violent tendencies, particularly directed against Buddhist heretics and Jains after his conversion. But it wasn't to nearly the same scale or as indiscriminate, according to the Ashoka Vedana. He also sent out missionaries, both to the fringes of his territory and beyond, with a mission to spread Buddhism far and wide. Several were sent to the Seleucids and former Seleucid territories in Iran. These missionaries also included the first known efforts to establish relations in Southeast Asia, in the modern regions of Myanmar and Thailand. And to celebrate all of this, Ashoka commissioned his 14 rock edicts, large stelae scattered around the empire. They were inscribed with the Gandharan script, apparently derived from Achaemenid imperial Aramaic at some point in the preceding 300 years. And in the Western territories, these inscriptions were multilingual. They featured Greek and Aramaic translations to be read by locals. In it, Ashoka claimed that the Dharma, righteous moral order in Indian religions, similar to Zoroastrian Asha, had conquered the lands of the Greek kings. This wasn't a military conquest, but a declaration that he was sending out Buddhist missionaries to convert the West. This did not work in the long run, but it began the process of spreading Buddhist thought into Western philosophy. It also suggests that Ashoka wanted to establish far-reaching diplomatic ties. He names Antiochus, Ptolemy, and Antigonus, our recurring big three, but also Magus of Kyrene, and Alexander II of Epirus. Ashoka wanted all of the Western powers, big and middling, to hear the good words of the Buddha. This is both the first sign of contact between Buddhists and Europeans, and the first suggestion of diplomatic ties between Indian and European powers. The Rock Edicts, although they probably were not the first written works in Iron Age India, are the oldest surviving example. It will take time before the full ramifications of this contact really develop in our narrative, centuries really, but they're out there now, and we will be dealing with the lingering presence of Buddhist influence for the next 800 years. Like I said, there's so much more to say about Ashoka. He will be around for a while. Antiochus I, on the other hand, died right around the same time his eastern neighbor found religion. So next time, we should really talk about the Seleucid royal family. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.